Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello, welcome back to Black's History Week. In this episode, Professor Jeremy Black, author of A Brief History of Germany, talks to The Critic's deputy editor, Graham Stewart, about the Weimar Republic and whether its collapse blinds us to its achievements.
The Weimar Republic, which was the government of Germany from 1919 to 1933, is a controversial period in German history, essentially because it is the prelude to the Third Reich established by Adolf Hitler in 1933. And there are standard matters of discussion, notably as to whether there was any viability for Weimar, whether its fall was inevitable or the matter of contingency, whether it was, as it were, founded under a damned inheritance, that of the Versailles peace settlement, i.e. Supposedly the victors are responsible for the rise of Adolf Hitler, and which is a rather bizarre argument, but we'll leave that to one side. Whether the culture of Germany in the 1920s, its dynamism as an area of the expression of new ideas, new concepts, new forms of art, in some respects, is a distraction from fundamental deep-seated problems. Now, you won't be surprised to hear, Graham, that there are no definitive answers. There can't be definitive answers. History, by its nature, is an interim report. And I think it's also fair to say that, as before, when we've been looking at German history, and indeed in our earlier programmes on things like French, British, Spanish, Italian, and American history, I think, as before, what one actually needs to do is to contextualize the situation, to those people who look at German history on its own, the usual phrase given is the idea of a unique or exceptional development pattern, a Sonderweg, are actually sort of rather limited, because one needs to ask questions about why, given period B, the 1920s, or period C, the impact of the slump of 1929 and the subsequent depression, why some countries went in one particular way and other countries in a different way. So just to try and move apart from Germany in a second, and just to give some contextualization, Germany was not unique in having been defeated in World War I, nor was it treated particularly harshly by the victorious powers compared to the fate of, for example, the Ottoman Empire, which lost much of its empire, which suffered a really serious form of civil war, in effect, as well as foreign invasion and its aftermath, nor was Germany as harshly treated as the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which also, in the aftermath of World War I, had all sorts of issues and problems, not least the establishment of a communist republic in Hungary, the Belakun Republic, named after its leader, and then sort of foreign intervention, invasions, etc., etc. So compared to that, Germany was more in the sort of case of Bulgaria, which is not a comparison that German historians would particularly relish, but there we go, as a defeated power that was relatively generously treated. In terms of those whom you might consider, and of course there is all sorts of definitional issues, Germans, there was not, for example, the mass expulsions that you were to see after World War II. There was not Germany losing what would have been considered integral German lands, as, for example, Marshal Foch wanted a partition that would include a separate German Rhineland. There wasn't an end of a German army, etc., etc. So Germany itself, although it subsequently derived a sort of victim narrative that would have dealt, would have, as it were, happily joined in terms of the quality of its exposition, and its academic backers, as well as other backers, and of course extremist backers, the sort of victim approach seen with some of the victim narratives of the modern world, actually you've got to put it a bit more in context. Democracy is established in Germany in 1919. Again, if you're putting that in comparison, Russia, which had been defeated, forced to peace in 1917-18, did not have that possibility. It had a civil war, it had enormous loss of people, social cohesion, institutional capital, and of course was set up a vile dictatorship in the case of the Soviet Union, which was ever bit as willing to murder large numbers of fellow Soviets as Germany was to show under Adolf Hitler. So again, one has to be cautious if one is looking at this in a wider context. So what can we say about Weimar? Well, we can certainly say that there is violence from the outset in 1920. But again, that's not exactly unique. There is political violence across much of Europe in this period. And I think it's reasonable to point out that extremists of left and right are a challenge to many states in the aftermath of World War I, and certainly into 1923, 1924 across much of Europe. Again, many of the disruptions you see in that period are not unique. The 1919 flu pandemic, which was a genuinely disturbing flu pandemic. I mean, COVID was a walk in the park compared to that, and also fundamentally affected old people like myself and not the young. I mean, the flu pandemic of 1919 was far more vicious, not least in affecting pregnant women and younger people. And on top of that, high inflation after the war, the economic disruption of dislocation after the war, and a degree of social chaos, which you see with refugees, with families grieving their war dead. None of these are unique to Germany. They may have contrasted very much with a sense of German exceptionalism and pride prior to the war. But an interesting comparison would be, I've not seen it made, I'm sure somebody has made it, but I myself haven't noticed it, the effect on France of the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 to 71, which in the short term caused political extremism. I think the Paris Commune could be happily defined of that. And of course, far more people got killed in suppressing the Paris Commune than died in all and every political violence within Germany between 1919 and the end of the 1920s. And then subsequent to that, the 1870s and 1880s, moving up to the Boulanger attempted coup, or was it, were periods of enormous uncertainty, I think that's being polite, in French politics. There were revanchist groups, many of which wanted to restore monarchy. There was only a limited support for the Third Republic, with a profound hostility to it, which you again see in the following decade with the Dreyfus Affair. And again, compared to that, Germany in the 1920s is stable. It's maybe not a comparison German historians would like, but they need to get out more and look at other countries of that period. And I think, again, if you're thinking of major world states of that period going through transformation after political change in the 19-teens, which is essentially what you're talking about in the case of Germany, you could argue that China, which had had its revolution, getting rid of its imperial system. Eventually, by the end of the 1920s, had consolidated around a Kuomintang government, nationalist government of a reformist type, which had territorial control over most of China, principal exception being in Manchuria. But that had required far more use of force than the situation in Germany. So, you know, we could run through, I discuss in detail in my brief history, some of the particular problems of that decade. But I think, you know, one needs to be aware that in many senses, in the 1920s, in Germany, there were many who were committed to internationalism, liberalism, democracy, and free market capitalism. The Weimar Republic, which was established in 1919 with elections, returned a very clear majority for the democratic parties, notably the German Democratic Party, the so-called pre-war left liberals. And of course, you know, attempts to overthrow these were not, you know, they were to a certain degree reliant on the army, which brutally suppressed the violent opposition of 1920. Well, we say brutally, of course, I say brutally. Again, I ought to get out more when I'm saying that compared to what Lenin and Trotsky were doing in 1920. It was a walk in the park. But, you know, the communists were defeated in 1920. Hitler, of course, was a failure with his attempted beer hall putsch in Munich in 1923, which was very rapidly suppressed. And if you think about it, that was obviously designed to emulate the seizures of power carried out in Turkey, the former Ottoman Empire, by Mustafa Kemal, and also in Italy by Benito Mussolini. 20 people were killed in the beer hall putsch. Well, you know, that's not desirable. It was more than, for example, were killed in you know, in labor disputes and other problems in Britain in the 19-teens. But it has to be, and you know, the British put tanks on the streets of Glasgow in 1919, but it has to be said, 20 people is only 20 people. Hitler was arrested, he was imprisoned at Landsberg prison. And thereafter, during the 1920s, there was violence associated with Nazi bully boys and thugs, but he didn't attempt to mount another coup because, of course, he was aware it would fail, that the authorities were more powerful, more potent than he would have liked to have imagined. And on top of that, the army showed itself able and willing to defend its sense of order. So, for example, in 1923, it acted against the SPD communist government in Saxony. I think if we're looking at Weimar, you can see it as a period of both hope and despair, which is exactly what you'd expect in a post-war era. That there are obviously the issues, the recurrent issues of German state building from the late 19th century, the relationship between regions and centre, the relationships between capital and labour, the response to international contingencies. You know, there is a potent breeze into the system of sort of into the stew of arguments that things have all been awful and everything is terrible. But it has to be said that, you know, much of the extremism, the protectionism, the misery that we associate with the early 1930s, in many senses stemmed from the developments of the Great Depression. And one has to be very cautious of exaggerating the degree to which these were mainstream in the 1920s. I'm reminded of a rather weak book by Richard Overy on interwar Britain, in which he argues, you know, that these were, that this was a profoundly disturbed society, which was not exactly how those people who returned to the national government with thumping great majorities in 31 or 35, or indeed the Conservatives in the 20s would have seen it. There was obviously in the new Weimar state the difficulties of grounding a parliamentary democracy, of operating a federation of states, of land, of abandoning the monarchies, of coping with defeat and severe economic and financial dislocation, and of confronting the revolutionary example and expansion of communism. And it wasn't easy to create structures and processes, a sense of legitimacy and of national unity, but Weimar did it. I mean, it produced a republican system, it produced a parliamentary practice of government, and it granted votes to women. The powers of the central government increased under Weimar, particularly with regard to finance, but Germany remained a federal state, and each of the land was responsible for police, for justice, local government, education, and much else. And crucially, what this did was reflected, as indeed modern Germany does, or modern America does, or modern Switzerland does, the particular, within the federal structure, the particular inclinations of individual areas. What else could I possibly point out? Well, part of the narrative of, how Germany was lumped with enormous reparations. Well, first of all, one's got to remember, France had been lumped with enormous reparations in 1815 and again in 1871. That hadn't prevented subsequent French being able to pay off the reparations and to then grow. It was understandable that the reparations were imposed. They were imposed partly because of those earlier examples, but partly also to compensate for war damage, acute war damage. The war had largely been fought on French and Belgian soil, and war damage in places like Reims, or Reims, as the British call it. You wouldn't expect people to be delighted and to sing in the streets about reparations, but it's worth bearing in mind that support for Weimar was more significant than the hatred for it shown by people like the Freikorps. And it's also worth bearing in mind that, yes, there was a crisis in the Ruhr in 1923 and it helped provoke hyperinflation, but then it didn't lead to a wider conflict, nor indeed to Rhenish separatism. And by 1925, a considerable degree of stability had been regained. And Weimar, which is the word we usually use for the Weimar Republic, appeared resilient. That was a point that was subsequently to be derided by those who pressed for the chaos masquerading as order of the National Socialist state. But I think we have to be very wary of buying into Nazi propaganda as a form of modern intellectual analysis of the Weimar years. And I think this is very, very significant. On the left, there was a tendency to argue, the communist state of the Soviet Union was seen as the form of workers' legitimacy, and there was a tendency to regard Weimar as a bourgeois state and therefore another form of unacceptable governance, and that view has percolated through into some modern analysis. It's deeply flawed. It reflects an inability to understand that there are distinctions between non-left-wing governments, and it reflects a very crude form of political social analysis. So if you're looking at Weimar, the Deutschmark was stabilized in 1923-24. The foreign minister Stresemann proved a master of realpolitik, offering a new iteration of Bismarck's skill in that, but in a very different context. In 1926, Germany was able to join the League of Nations. So in other words, sooner, I believe, than the situation after World War II. And social welfare included the introduction in 1927 of universal and contributory unemployment insurance. Now, if we just take one more point before we discuss this, I've already mentioned that there is this legacy of failure in the sense of the subsequent rise of Hitler. I think it's fair to say that possibly looks less secure as an analysis once one starts to think about the difficulties that have affected many European countries after the great years of economic expansion, the 30 glorious years, as the French put it, that followed World War II came to an end. And I think one has seen the difficulties that some European states have struggled with in controlling and containing more extreme political sentiments, and dare one say it, that includes the extent to which there are mainstream, one has to be careful how one describes them, but extreme political parties that exist in the current German political sphere. I think one has to be therefore more cautious in evaluating the earlier situation. And what I'd sum up by saying is that Weimar faced the strain. It was an undoubted strain of the Versailles settlement and the crises of inflation and later the slump. Those encouraged many, but far from all, turn to extremism.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Black, for that overview. I think very interesting the points you make about seeing 1920s Germany's problems in the context of problems that other countries were dealing with at the same time. And also, I think the point of the extent to which by the second half of the 1920s, it seems to me the governments of the Weimar Republic have got actually a lot to be quite proud of. They have overcome many of the problems that this fledgling republic has at the time of its formation. I wonder if, if we just go through a few of those issues that it overcame, and just I'd be keen to get your assessment of how they were overcome. So, I mean, firstly, the putsches. There was a right-wing cap putsch in Berlin, a communist revolution in Munich, the lawlessness, the paramilitary forces, and so on. The government society managed to regain control, the constitutional government, I should say, managed to regain control over a semi-anarchic situation.
Well, I think there is no doubt about it that what you're talking about is, like most political crises, only a relatively small number of people are active and therefore, as it were, dealing with, or this group succeeding to pay or being suppressed, is the clear issue. In 1920, the army proved very important in suppressing opposition. The actions were not particularly always welcome. They included the execution of prisoners and the killing of bystanders. But, you know, this was street violence on the streets of the national capital, and it did play a major role. I mean, the willingness of the army to provide evidence of its support for Weimar very much contrasted with the assumptions that had been made by many on either the right or the left. The left, of course, with the notion that, you know, the soldiers as workers wouldn't fight on other workers, which was naive and stupid. The right, the notion that the army as an authoritarian system would naturally support those who shouted right-wing slogans, which was also a flawed analysis. But no, I think that was a very important and consequential situation. The defeat of the communists in 1920 and of Hitler in 1923 was achieved with, for example, if you contrast it with the Soviet Union, far fewer people killed than when the communists suppressed the Kronstadt Rising, you know, the rising at the naval base outside Petrograd, St. Petersburg, Leningrad, whatever you want to call it. And I think it's fair to say that there was only a relatively limited attempt by extremists to actually overthrow the system. Now, that may not seem, you know, how you would see it in background. For example, you know, there was a terrorist movement, the organization Consul Terrorist Movement, which included a group of former Freikorps, and they killed at least 354 people in 1920 to 22, including the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Foreign Affairs, the first in 1921, the second in 1922. And these were terrible things, and they were deliberately designed to sap Weimar. But in the end of the day, they failed. Just as, for example, if you're looking at another new republic established in that very period, the new Irish Free State, well, it was a dominion, it wasn't quite a republic yet, but it was in effect an independent republic. The new Irish Free State, you know, it suppressed the risings of the anti-treaty IRA. Executed those, executed more people than the British they executed, incidentally, and it, you know, brought order. The communists were suppressed in Hungary with many more casualties. So I think one has to put the German situation in context.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the inflation? To what extent do you see that as simply the wrong monetary policies that the central bank was pursuing, or as a deliberate attempt to inflate away such reparations as were paid? And how was inflation effectively brought under control?
Well, do you know, I am not a financial expert, so I don't want to pretend a counterfactual skill at working out what might or would have happened if a separate approach had been followed. I think it's fair to say that there had been in wartime what we might call quantitative easing, and in all countries. And as we know, the reintroduction of stable money policies, sound money policies, was not easy. It was not easy even in among the victors like Britain and France. France did better than Britain at it. So again, I wouldn't see it as uniquely a German issue. I think there was too much money in circulation. I think that in a sense, whatever the bank had done, there would have been high inflation. And, you know, obviously the situation is very different to today. But again, today we see the consequences of loose money policies inflating the money supply. What a surprise, there's inflation. And then what a surprise, we can all blame it on foreigners. But in fact, it's actually, a lot of it is a matter of the inflation of the money supply within particular countries, as indeed was the case in the 20s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So let me turn to the way in which Germany got itself back into a family of nations. There is the Locarno Treaty of 1925. The following year, it joins the League of Nations. Should this be seen as really the achievements of the statesmanship of the foreign minister, Gustav Stresemann? Was there something he brought specifically that moved this process of diplomatic normalization forward? Or was it actually conscious decisions, do you think, more in terms of other powers, particularly the United States, Britain and France, that it was actually also in their interest to have a form of normalization?
Well, I think it was in their interest to have a form of normalization. I think there was a desperate concern to try and limit the opportunities of the of Soviet expansionism. And there was a real concern, a justified concern, about German-Soviet alignment and possibilities, as indeed a justified concern, because these were to be seen with the Soviets providing opportunities for the German military to thwart the Versailles restrictions on Germany testing new weapon systems. So I think that's very important. Also, I think as part of the post-World War I, you get a parallel with what had happened after 1815, the attempt to bring France rapidly into the new system of the so-called Congress powers, rather than to leave France as a discontented power that might, provide an opportunity for a new Bonapartism or a new radicalism that would challenge the other states. So, I don't find it surprising that Britain and France would welcome the situation. And again, you can see the analogy after World War II, where the restrictions of the victorious powers on Japan are relaxed when Japan is needed, is more necessary after the communist victory in China in 49 and after communist advances in Korea. And you could say the same thing in with the case of West Germany in the mid-1950s. There is a need for the Bundeswehr, for the establishment of the Bundeswehr, in order to act as a sort of restriction on the expansion of or the potential expansion of the Soviet Union. Stresemann plays his hand well, but he is dependent for playing it on the international concerns and the fact, again, I've always in favour of looking at the wider context. The prime issue is not Germany. The prime issue is how do you confront the Soviet Union, which after all had defeated the interventionist powers during the Russian Civil War and had then gone on in as part of that process in 1920 to challenge Poland. It had been thwarted by the Poles, supported by British and French military advice and equipment. But there was a continued anxiety. There's a 1923 war panic about Soviet expansionism. There's an awareness of Soviet infiltration, espionage, and active agitation in stirring up the possibility of revolution elsewhere. So yes, Germany is, as it were, a second order priority to the relationship with the Soviet Union.
I wonder if we can turn now to parliamentary politics. You mentioned that the Weimar Republic has universal suffrage, women have the vote. As we've discussed in previous episodes, the role of the Reichstag has been significant, but before the First World War, it wasn't taking many of the commanding executive decisions. I wonder if you can say a bit more about how the constitutional balance has changed during this period of the Weimar Republic.
Well, I mean, you've got a presidency, and it's a key moment that when Hindenburg succeeds Friedrich Ebert of the SPD as president in 1925. So the president has a lot of powers, particularly to appoint the chancellor. And, that's, I think, a very significant one. It's obviously to be significant in the rise of Hitler. It's significant prior to that. There is the relationship, as indeed you have today, between national politics and the politics at the level of the individual provinces. And again, there was a redrawing of the provincial system, but Prussia can remains, I suppose, overly strong. I mean, it contained about 60% of Germany's territory and population. And I think it's fair to say that the part of the different stabilization after World War II was that Prussia was broken down, as it were, and as a land, as a regional area. I've already mentioned that much of government was handled by the provinces, and I think that tends to be underplayed if people too much focus on the Reichstag.
Mm-hmm. should we though see, I mean, the difference between pre-war and post-war parliamentary politics is there are, you know, extremist parties, that the Nazis, the communists, and so on, which there weren't in the Kaiserreich. But in other respects, is there a lot of continuation? You know, the SPD is still there, centre-left, and the Catholic and centre-right parties.
Oh yes, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's an enormous degree of continuity, and I think it's there that you see part of the strength of the Weimar system, that, as it were, existing political groups, which unsurprisingly had helped to create Weimar, with the principal difference being that there isn't going to be a monarchy, not just the imperial monarchy, but also monarchy in places like Bavaria, etc., Saxony. But that continuity, as we know, is to be challenged eventually by the rise of the communists and of the Nazis. And I think it's worth saying that exists prior to the Depression, but is pushed forward by the Depression and the slump. So you could argue that the coalition government headed by Hermann Müller, who had been the chancellor, had been from the SPD since 1928, that government collapses in March 1930 because he's unable to put together a politically acceptable solution to the problems of funding rapidly rising unemployment payments, which you will recall is an issue in the British creation of the national government and the fall of the governing Labour government in 1931. So prior to that, there is already economic and political strain, problems over liquidity, a degree of political radicalization, not just in terms of the Nazis and the communists, though both are significant, but also, for example, in a movement to the right in the center parties. All of those need to be mentioned. But I think it's really the crises of 1930 that sort of caused the problem. So, you know, we've got Müller resigning. He is replaced by the centre party's Heinrich Brüning, who's appointed by Hindenburg, who follows deflationary policies, and in the event they hit both society and economy without bringing stability. Unemployment continues to rise. Again, Germany is far from unique in that. And with the government unpopular, again, Germany far from unique, and lacking a majority in the Reichstag, Brüning uses Hindenburg to issue presidential emergency decrees. And that creates what is in effect an authoritarian democracy. Again, I wouldn't say that's at all unique for this period. And I would say it's not so much that there is an authoritarian democracy that is the problem, it's that this authoritarian democracy is unstable. And that, I would say, is the real problem. I mean, I don't know whether you want to go through this programme. I suspect we should leave it to another programme to discuss the crisis that leads to the rise to power of Adolf Hitler. But what I would say is, not only is the fall of Weimar not inevitable, it also shouldn't be argued that because it changed its modus operandi, never that necessarily meant that it also would fall or that it lost validity. I think that is something one is, you know, would something I'd be confusing. What I'd rather conclude on is to just make one or two comments about the culture of Weimar, because I think that is part of its contribution and strength as far as the global history of the 20th century is concerned. And, you know, if you're thinking of, for example, the Bauhaus movement in architecture, if you're thinking of music, the operas of Kurt Weill, if you're thinking of painting, the sort of rather savage realism of Otto Dix or George Grotz. If you're thinking of atonal music, Schoenberg, who I don't personally like at all, but nevertheless was clearly influential. Or if you think of cinema, the expressionist films, notably of Fritz Lang, such as Metropolis in 1927, they're all important. Now, I think you need to be clear about this. Many of these did not attract public approval, and the vibrancy of the cultural life includes many other themes and styles in this period. But what it shows is the diversity and dynamism of Weimar, and I do think that that is worth commenting on.
Well, indeed it is. We're going to discuss how Hitler came to power in the next episode, but Professor Jeremy Black, for taking us through the Weimar Republic, both the problems it encountered and overcame, as well as the problems it couldn't solve, and also, of course, referencing your brief history of Germany, which is now published. Thank you very much indeed.
A pleasure.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.